It is time for us to talk to Dr. Peter Attia, a leading expert on the science of longevity, how to live better and longer. He's a graduate of Stanford University School of Medicine and trained at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in General Surgery. He's also a surgical oncology fellow at the National Cancer Institute, where his research focused on immune-based therapies for melanoma. His focus has turned over the years away from treating people with life-threatening cancer to understanding how we can avoid what he calls the four horsemen, the big killers of cancer, heart disease, diabetes and Alzheimer's. Peter Attia serves on the editorial board for the journal Aging. He's host of The Drive, one of the most popular podcasts covering the topics of health, medicine and longevity. And in his latest book, Outlive, The Science and Art of Longevity, he draws on the latest research on what we can do to live well and for longer. That's from food to sleep, emotional and mental health, as well as physical activity. He is with us and on the line from the United States. Peter, kia ora, hello and welcome to 9 to Noon. Thank you for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
The big focus of your work, it's not just about extending life, prolonging life, but it's also prolonging quality of life. And in your book, you repeatedly talk, instead of just about lifespan, but about health span. Can you explain that one to us?
Sure. You know, when people think of longevity, I think they often think of lifespan, which is understandable because that's, I think, the more straightforward metric to understand. It's obviously how long you live. It's, you know, a binary readout, if you will. But health span, which is the quality of life, is just as important to longevity. And it really doesn't get as much attention, probably in part because it's maybe a little harder to understand. It has more components to it. It has a physical component. I think everybody understands that as you age, you get, you know, weaker, you ache more, you have more pains, your cognition tends to decline. But there's another component to health span, which is less tethered to your age. And that's maybe something about the quality of your life with respect to emotional health, the quality of your relationships, happiness, joy, things of that nature. So all of these things taken together make up health span. And without some attention to those things, I think longevity with a focus on lifespan is actually quite meaningless potentially.
Because essentially you are measuring it more in terms of the number that people live to rather than the good number of years that they have in getting to that point.
That's exactly right.
So the big diseases that mainstream medicine has not yet cracked, we're talking about heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, type 2 diabetes. What is it that medicine in the current age is failing to do to really adequately tackle these?
Well, you know, all of these diseases have something in common, which is they kill you very slowly, right? And in the book, I talk about these as being slow deaths, and I contrast those with fast death. Fast death is what really killed us up until about 150 years ago, or even 100 years ago. Most people died of fast deaths. They died from infections, they died from trauma, things of that nature. And so the current system of medicine, what I call medicine 2.0, was really built around combating those illnesses. And it did so very successfully. So, you know, I always want to be careful that I don't poo-poo medicine, because medicine really, in its current form, has done a remarkable thing, which is to say it has literally doubled life expectancy from about 40 to about 80, just on the back of reducing death from the communicable and infectious diseases along with trauma. But it's really reached its limit. And that's evident when you look at the plateau and in some places declining life expectancy in the developed world. And that just suggests we need a new approach, right? We need a new approach if we're going to live any longer, and certainly if we're going to live better.
And so what does that new approach look like?
Well, it's going to require looking at all pieces of longevity and asking the question, how do you go about addressing them? So let's start with lifespan. When it comes to addressing the four horsemen, we can learn an interesting lesson by paying attention to a certain subgroup of individuals called centenarians. So, you know, everybody's heard of centenarians. These are the people who live to 100 or beyond. And they're obviously a very rare subset of the population. Now, without going into, you know, all the details about it, I can give you the punchline. The punchline is centenarians are genetically very blessed. So their gift of long life comes not through any behavior, but rather through their genes. So genes don't play an enormous role in longevity through about the eighth decade of life, but thereafter, genes play a significant role. And what their genes give them is protection from the onset of these diseases, but not protection from the diseases once they kick in. In other words, the gift of being a centenarian is that you get chronic diseases, these four horsemen, about two decades later. But once you get them, you're just as susceptible to them as the rest of us. So the major insight here is that if you want to live longer and better, which they do, you have to delay the onset of chronic disease, not figure out ways to live longer with chronic disease. So that's really the fundamental insight on the living longer piece. And so each of those has a strategy, meaning the way you would go about preventing and delaying the onset of heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's disease, that looks very different than how we treat those diseases today.
I was interested as well in the kind of the overlap that you discuss in the book between these various horsemen. Are you able to give us a bit of a précis of that and how these various conditions can quite often interact?
Yes. One of those horsemen in particular, the horseman that revolves around diabetes, that's type 2 diabetes, and insulin resistance, is effectively a multiplier of the others. In other words, if you find yourself in a situation where you have high levels of insulin, which is the canary in the coal mine towards having what's called insulin resistance, and eventually, you know, things like fatty liver disease, which is an epidemic here in the United States and elsewhere in the developed world, and ultimately type 2 diabetes, your risk of those other three horsemen, cancer, heart disease, dementia, your risk of those things goes up by anywhere from 1.5 to 2 times, meaning 50 to 100% increase in the risk of those other diseases. And so therein lies a very important principle of medicine 3.0, which is you must remain metabolically as healthy as possible in order to take the first step at reducing your risk of those others.
And so the health system, as you mentioned, medicine 2.0, is where we're at now. If that's the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff with these four horsemen, what does a new approach look like? And is it a much more proactive and individualized look at health for people?
It is in some ways. So one of the other things that really defined the era of medicine 2.0, the current system, is something called the randomized control trial, where we take a large number of people, we subject them to a relatively simple intervention. Usually it's something like take this pill to lower your cholesterol or take this pill to lower your blood pressure. And we look at the results on average of what happens on the other side. But if anyone looks really closely at these studies, you'll realize that while on average they produce an interesting result, the variability is significant. In other words, people are different. This is not a surprise. Anybody who's thought about this for more than a minute will realize that two people can respond very differently to the same treatment. And we need to understand that a little bit better to understand who, in fact, is better suited for various treatments over others. So this is one way that we might think about how to personalize treatments. Now, we don't yet have great tools to do this at the genetic level. I don't think our genes offer us the best insight, but we can look at many other biomarkers to understand how people are responding to various treatments and decide that this person with high blood pressure might respond better this way, whereas this person might respond better that way. And the same is true across all treatable conditions. I think the second thing that we have to really think about is how much are we underutilizing the tools that are not really under the umbrella of medicine at all. You know, when I went to medical school, and this is true of anybody who went to medical school, we learned a great deal about how to make a diagnosis and how to offer treatment vis-a-vis pharmacologic intervention or procedure. And again, those things matter. But what we didn't learn with any specificity was how to apply exercise or nutrition or sleep or stress management as tools. And it turns out those things probably have a much greater impact than pharmacologic things. So I think pharmacologic tools are very important and are a part of medicine 3.0. But the real lift comes from utilizing these other, and I hate the term, but we call them lifestyle interventions. I hate the term because it's very soft. But, you know, exercise, just to give you one example, is hands down the most potent tool you have if your aim is to live a longer, better life. Nothing comes close, actually. And yet, if you go to your doctor and ask, how should I exercise? He or she doesn't really have great advice, certainly not with the specificity that they might have if you have high blood pressure and they need to figure out which drug to give you.
So how would you say to people, how would you have that conversation with patients about what they should be doing around exercise to optimize their health span?
Well, it starts with an inventory of what they're doing currently. So if a patient is not exercising at all, and you know that's actually the majority of the population, I would say that by simply going from no exercise a week to 3 hours of exercise a week, you're going to reduce your all-cause mortality by about 50%. What that means is in any given year, your risk of death goes down by 50% from all causes, just by going from completely sedentary to 3 exercise hours a week. So I start with just something as basic as that. Now, what we do with our patients is we say, let's reverse engineer this problem. How many hours a week are you willing to exercise? Understanding, by the way, that there is no upper limit to the value. In other words, there's no upper limit to how fit or how strong you can be, which are two things you're only going to acquire by more exercise, and the benefit that that will have on lifespan and health span. And then if a patient says, well, look, I'm willing to do 5 hours a week of that, then we back from there into what does that look like? How should that time be divided if it's, say, 5 hours a week?
Because it's not just about doing cardio or just about strength or just about, you know, flexibility. It's about everything, isn't it?
That's right. And a general rule of thumb would be as follows. And again, the details are going to come down to each individual and kind of go through those details. But as a general rule, we would advise a patient to say, look, half of that time should be spent doing cardio and half of that time should be spent on strength and stability. And that half that is put into cardio, 80% of that should be at a modest level of intensity. In the book, I go into great detail about this. I call it zone two. But what that really means for just a rule of thumb is zone two is a level of intensity where you can still carry out a conversation, but it's a little bit uncomfortable. So if you, if you're going for a walk and you can talk easily, that's not quite intense enough to produce a training value. So while there's a lot of value in being outdoors and walking, that doesn't really constitute the level of training we're talking about. And conversely, if you're out there and you're exercising, you're running or you're doing whatever, but you can't carry out a conversation, then that's at a higher level of intensity, which shouldn't be a part of that 80%. So that 80% needs to be in the sweet spot, and the other 20% needs to be above that level. That is the most efficient way to improve your cardio fitness to produce the desired training effect. So if a person says, hey, I'm willing to, do 2 hours a week of cardio, then you would say 80% of that should be at the low intensity and 20% of that should be at the higher intensity. And similarly, on the strength front, we think about 80% of that should be strength training, resistance training, which is, again, imperative for all aspects of health, be it metabolic health, physical health, structural health, metabolic health, as I said, glucose disposal. And then 20% of that should be geared towards some form of stability training. So, there are various ways to do this, but Pilates is one way that people might be familiar with what that type of training is. So that involves movement patterns, that involves flexibility, that involves strengthening core muscles and things of that nature that serve to, reduce back injuries, knee injuries, and things of that nature.
You're with 9 to Noon. We're talking with Peter Attia, his latest book, Outlive: The Science and Art of Longevity. If I can ask you about, I think you term it nutritional biochemistry in the book, something else that people will be familiar with as a way of increasing their health, basically what and how much we eat. People's diets are pretty crucial here as well, especially in the modern age.
Absolutely. I mean, for most of our history, for most of our evolutionary history, we lived in a very food scarce environment. And so We had to eat anything and everything we could. And one of the most important evolutionary adaptations was our ability to store excess energy. In fact, this is probably the single most important feature that allowed us as humans to leapfrog all other species to the top of the evolutionary food chain. And the reason for that is we developed these enormous brains, and these brains of ours are very energy consuming. So our brains consume a vast disproportionate amount of energy relative to the rest of our body, and therefore any crisis of energy shortage would be incongruent with us developing them. So that served us really well until food became so abundant that now we have this problem of excess energy. We have too much energy. And that's the fundamental problem that's facing most people today, is we're metabolically unhealthy because of excess energy. So for most people, the important parts of energy come down to two things. It's probably reducing total energy intake, which means reducing total nutrition, but doing so while keeping one of the macronutrients very high. And that macronutrient is protein, which is essential for the maintenance of muscle mass. And this becomes even more important as people age.
And so something like that, you're not sort of recommending a particular type of diet as such. But protein being the main focus is something that for a lot of people that can be quite hard to do.
It is. It does require a lot of attention. And we, instruct our patients to try to get between 0.8 and 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight. So an easier way to think about this might be, because I want to be culturally sensitive to where we're talking right now, think of it in about 1 gram per kilo of body weight. So, pardon me, 2 grams per kilo of body weight. So for most people, that's more than what they're eating now. And that requires being very deliberate about where you're getting your food from. For many people, that requires using something supplemental. So typically once a day, I'll probably supplement my protein intake with a shake, using like a high quality whey protein, mixing it with some berries and some almond milk or something like that. I'm a little lactose intolerant, so I'm not going to put milk in there, and blending up a shake to get, say, an extra 30 or 40 grams of protein. This is, again, it's relatively agnostic to the diet, right? It's not about, being on this type of diet or that type of diet. It turns out that those things are far less important than being in energy balance and getting sufficient protein. So in some ways, that's really good news, right? That says that, if you fancy a Mediterranean diet, that's fine. If you fancy a low carb diet, that's fine. If you fancy a paleo diet, that's fine. If you fancy a vegetarian diet, that's fine. It does become a little bit harder on certain diets to get the required amount of protein, but even a vegetarian diet can still consume plenty of protein through dairy and eggs, as an example.
You do also have an emphasis on some other things, which I think there's perhaps a growing awareness of how crucial these are to our overall health. Sleep, of course, which has been quite a lot of focus on. Also, emotional health. Why is it, or and how is it that emotional health matters as much as it does to you?
Well, I think it's, again, one of those things that I'm sure anybody would come to this conclusion if they allowed themselves to stop and reflect on it enough. But if the quality of your relationships is poor, if the quality of your interaction with other people, if the quality of your relationship with yourself is poor, if you're unhappy, if you don't feel connected to anything, anyone, or if you don't have a sense of purpose, a reason to exist beyond perhaps yourself, does it really matter how long you live? This was a question that was actually posed to me by my therapist at one point in time, which was, and this was her commenting on me many years ago, about 6 years ago. It was, isn't it a bit ironic that you spend all of this time and energy focusing on how long you're going to live without any attention to whether or not you're miserable during that period of time? And obviously, I've come to the conclusion that that's one of the most insightful things anybody's ever said to me. And it's completely changed how I think about this problem, which is to say that without your emotional house in order, I don't think any of this other stuff matters. In fact, you could argue to live a longer life with without that would be a form of torture.
You talk actually about some very deeply personal stuff that you yourself went through on a health journey. Are you able to share a little bit of that with us? Because I guess it hits pretty hard, this kind of stuff.
Yes, I mean, this was for me probably the greatest struggle was, you know, coming to grips with my past and realizing that I needed to get help in this way. I needed to get a lot of therapy and work through a lot of things that were, you know, producing behaviors in me that were obviously coping for things that had happened in the past, that on some level, those coping mechanisms turned out to be productive. They produced certain characteristics, such as, you know, a pursuit of academic excellence, always working very hard, perfectionism. These are things that on some levels can be positive, but if left unchecked, they can be quite negative and they can be quite destructive to me as an individual and to the people around me vis-a-vis my relationships. And so, you know, I found myself in a situation where my, you know, I basically was losing my family as a result of my own behaviors. And that became my motivation to address this problem with the same amount of vigor that I had, you know, gone after all the other problems that I detected health-wise. For example, you know, trying to reduce my risk of heart disease, which is something that is very strong in my family.
How much of an insight do you think you gained going through that? You know, an extremely hard time that you detail in the book for not just for you, but indeed for your family and for others around you. But I guess you must have learned a lot.
Yeah, I learned the most important lessons of my life. And to be clear, these are not kind of one and done things, right? Just as, you know, if I were here to convince you today that, you know, you need to exercise more, it's one thing to realize that. But if you went to the gym tomorrow and had the best workout of your life and then didn't work out anymore, that really wouldn't produce any lasting effect. And so the only way that exercise works is if you keep doing it. The only way your nutrition works for you is if you continue to stick to it, which is why, by the way, going back to what I say, it's far less relevant what particular diet you're on. It's more important that you find one that works for you. And you know, again, in the book, I walk through all the different strategies and all the different ways to think about that. And the same is true here. It's not enough to sort of come to these insights. I think you have to put into practice, into daily practice, the types of behaviors and the types of tools that help you make this an ongoing part of recovery. And that's how I think about it. I think of it as a sort of recovery journey.
So it's about consistency. It's about, you know, keep on keeping on. It does encompass large aspects of people's lives. And what would you say to people who, you know, perhaps someone listening who's thinking, you know, all this sounds great, but it's quite overwhelming and I don't even know where to start. This is too hard.
I think that's a perfectly normal and understandable response. And I can tell you that with our patients, we've learned a lot, right? I think there was a day when I used to want to tackle all of these issues at once. You know, you spend a month getting to know a patient, doing all sorts of tests, learning every detail about this risk and that risk and where they stand today. And again, many years ago, my approach was, let's address all of these things at once. And there's the odd patient for whom that works. But I think for most people, you're right. That becomes more overwhelming than helpful. And so today, we try to optimize around two things. The first is, which of these things, meaning nutrition, exercise, mental health, et cetera, which of these things will produce the greatest benefit? And secondly, which do you feel most able to put time and energy into right now? Let's just pick one. Because what happens is if you start with that, you're going to get a benefit. And part of this is building a new habit. Part of this is developing confidence around the ability to change a habit and experience a benefit in response to that change. And it's much easier, I think, to do these things in some sort of serial succession than to try to bang all of them out in parallel. And yes, it might take a little bit longer to get the desired result, but it tends to be much more durable.
Thank you very much for your time. Fascinating stuff from Dr. Peter Attia there, a leading expert on the science of longevity, living better and for longer. And his latest book, an absolutely extraordinary read, it's Outlive, The Science and Art of Longevity. That is out now.